At only 15 years old, he took the throne. At 18, he marched into war, and he never stopped. The man slept in trenches, ate with soldiers, hated comfort, despised peace, wore the same threadbare uniform all his life, and believed destiny favored only the bold. While Europe schemed, Charles XII of Sweden charged straight into cannon fire, carving an empire with frostbitten hands and blind certainty. He defeated kings, defied reason, and lost everything to obsession. This is the story of a warrior king, a teenage conqueror who turned Sweden into a superpower and then rode it straight into oblivion. Blind History is brought to you by Vitruvius Design. Visit them at vitruviusdesign.co.za. In Blind History, we try to bring you stories of the well-known people and the villains, but we also try to find people in history that don't necessarily get the praise that they're due. And today's subject is exactly one of those. His name is King Charles XII of Sweden. And probably, I'm guessing, very few people outside of Sweden will even know he existed. Even people who study history don't pay a lot of attention to him. But he is a force of nature. And we'll talk about what his life was all about. My co-host, Anthony Meter, is here. He's also got loads of interesting info about Charles XII. How are you, Ant?
Good, and you, Gareth?
Fantastic. I love nothing more than talking about this.
Me too. I enjoyed Charles XII.
Yeah.
I enjoy the warrior kings, and he's quite late. He was born in 1682. If you look at the great warrior kings, they were much earlier. The great warrior kings, and this he's really up there.
Yeah, I mean he led from the front, as we'll get to in a moment. But this guy turned an entire kingdom into a personal action movie, if you ask me. So he was born, as you said, 1682. He began riding horses at age 4, and he started hunting bears at age 7.
And it made his the people looking after him very, very nervous, because he was the heir to the throne, and he used to do some crazy stuff. So I mean, fighting bears, the way he rode the horse,
cousin when they were kids, at age 11, they tried to kill a charging lion with their bare hands in the Stockholm Zoo, and they failed, but they survived.
Well.
Yeah,
shows you what to expect from him.
But I mean, at 11, that's ballsy. And I know he was very big on the Bible and on God. He learned Bible verses obsessively, and apparently when he went on all of his military campaigns, as soon as he was able, he only carried two things with him: a sword and a Bible.
Johanna, and that's exactly how he was. He didn't have time for anything else. But so when he said he wanted to bring peace to the Swedish Empire, and when he had peace, he would worry about, let's say, marriage, heirs.
Yeah.
At this particular time, the only thing he concentrated on was ensuring that he would get peace for Sweden.
Well, he apparently had no interest, not even the slightest interest, in wine, women, or even conversation. He didn't want to talk to people unless it was about war or horses or God. Those were his only three areas of interest. And he succeeded his father in 1697 at the age of 15, so a young man. And everybody in Europe thought, oh, goody, we can bully a teenage king. Denmark, Poland, Russia, all opposed to Sweden and competing for power in that realm. Big mistake, right?
Yeah, 100%. But it's also important to mention that Sweden wasn't... So we have to look at Sweden in the context that it was at the time, and in recent past, it's a very powerful nation, a very, very strong, known for its efficiency in war, So it wasn't a country at the time when he became king. It wasn't a weak country that was could be easily overthrown, and people and other countries or empires battled to get the front foot against Sweden, and that's why in this particular instance, yeah, they thought, okay, 15 years old, this is the best opportunity we've had in quite some time to actually. To sort this out and overthrow Sweden. So yes, I think that's exactly what they did. And another important point is that we weren't dealing with just Russia, we were dealing with Peter the Great. And yeah. And so he's, you know, I think we've covered him before, and Peter the Great is obviously known for throwing dwarfs, but also importantly, he was very good at fighting and war. So.
Yeah, and he had a big surprise coming once the Great Northern War got underway. But before that, the Norwegian campaign kicked off, and Charles, still a teenager, invented something called the Ski Commando. He basically retaliated against Denmark and sailed through a storm that was so violent that it sank half his fleet. Nonetheless, landed, marched directly on Copenhagen, the capital of Denmark, and won before the Danish had even eaten breakfast.
Exactly. Reminds me of Julius Caesar.
Unbelievable.
That's excellent. Unbelievable. And I think that first, and you can just understand that he's a teenager. So what he did, I think it didn't take long for him to take control. When he was 15, the father wanted regency of sort. And to his advisors to look after him, but they realized immediately that he was ready. They said he is ready, and he took over and effectively 100%. And this was his first look. Gareth, maybe to step back just a minute, he spent a lot of time with his dad fighting battles from the age. So sad, you know, he was very close to his mom, and the father loved his wife. So. When his father's wife died or his mom died, the family was traumatized, and so they brought the two closer together, and he took him everywhere. So I think he had a great chance. He saw what his father did, you know, when they went out on inspections and all kinds of official occasions. So he was on that side. He was well brought up, but I don't think anybody realized what was going on inside him, that the strength of character and what he would ultimately do in the end.
So you mentioned Peter the Great, and Russia went to war along with the other enemies, so Denmark, Poland, what was left of Denmark at that stage, against Sweden. And in 1700, there was this famous Battle of Narva. Now, apparently, the Russians outnumbered the Swedes by 4-1. And, you know, this Charles was incredible because he was a strategist as well as a gung-ho warrior himself. So he personally rode into cannon fire. They attacked during a snowstorm with bayonets, and he managed to destroy pretty much the entire Russian army. The Swedes had minimal casualties, and the Russians had catastrophic casualties. Peter the Great panicked after this battle and decided to rebuild the entire Russian military from scratch. That's how humiliating this was. So at a young age, Charles is already developing a reputation for being an absolute master on the battlefield.
Yeah, and I think, Gareth, you mentioned the blizzard. So the blizzard was key. They ensured, Charles ensured that they went with the blizzard. So then the Russians were, so the blizzard was driving into their eyes, and they couldn't actually see what was going on. They had, like you said, they had a much, much bigger army. And so the Swedes came in with the blizzard, so they could see everything, and they basically turned them over very quickly. Interestingly enough, Peter the Great wasn't there. So they brought, the Russians brought it up, but the fact that Peter the Great wasn't there. But what I liked a lot about the reaction of Peter the Great was that he really did go and rebuild. But it was this catalyst, this personality, this character, Charles the XII, that brought it out in the Russians.
Vitruvius design is for people who demand more than disposable design. It's for homeowners, architects, and developers who believe quality should last for decades, not seasons. Inspired by classical Roman principles, strength, usefulness, and beauty, Vitruvius curates premium European bathroom and kitchen fittings engineered to endure and designed to age gracefully. Every piece is accredited, rigorously tested, and backed by a 15-year warranty. Explore the collections at vitruviusdesign.co.za or visit the Vitruvius Design Showroom in De Waterkant, Cape Town, opening January 2026. I'm interested also in the Polish adventure, because this was his next thing. So apparently King Augustus II, who sounds like he was a complete loser as well, just a kind of a, like a frog. That's the only way I can describe him. Augustus II of Poland. So Charles XII of Sweden decides he doesn't like this guy, so he decides he'll just replace him as king because he's annoying.
He replaced him
with a more obedient king, but it was sort of like a hobby. He really treated Poland as a bit of a hobby.
Yeah, exactly. I think he did, and a little bit that started to backfire on him a little bit, you know, later on. And I think he didn't actually end up going back to Sweden after the that war. But Augustus was ultimately in the end replaced, like you said, with his own. Stanislaw, I think I can say his first name, but I think his surname is quite difficult for me to pronounce.
Yeah, Stanislaw is about right. So what's amazing about this is this guy, Charles the 12th, he never drank alcohol ever in his life. He had no known romantic relationships. He slept on the floor with his soldiers, used his saddle as a pillow. He also ate like a soldier, so he ate coarse bread, cheese. Sometimes he would even eat raw meat if that was all that was available. This guy was a proper warrior. He was meant to be like Adrian Carton de Wyatt and so many other warrior kings that we've covered in Blind History. He was meant to be on the battlefield. He also read scripture daily, believed he was the instrument of God's justice. And I think it's true. You can back this up if it is. He used gunpowder as a hair product because he loved gunpowder so much. So he used to put it in his hair.
He loved the smell of it.
Yeah,
100%. You have to smell of it. So that's exactly what he did. He was. You know, I think he was all in. But I think a little bit. You know, his Achilles heel, let's say, was he was a stubborn, and he refused. So there were many of his opponents that wanted to sue for peace. Let's offer peace, let's whatever it might be. And he was at the stage where he had brought Sweden to the absolute pinnacle of power. Mm. And Sweden wasn't just a country, they had their little empire of themselves, or a empire of themselves. But he refused to sue for, he refused many of the opportunities for peace. And for me, for the first time, I realized, because I didn't know this, but Russia used General Winter, like they did with Napoleon and like they did with Hitler. They used General Winter. Maybe it was one of the first times they've used it here in this situation. But Peter the Great then used it to his advantage. Mm-hmm. Why Charles XII went for Moscow rather than for St. Petersburg? People still wonder why he actually did that. But, you know, the Russians used the scorched earth policy. He attacked in late autumn, which the risks were too great. And he lost massive. This is a mistake. And if we look at Napoleon was at the pinnacle of power when he made this big mistake. Germany and Adolf Hitler were the brink of taking the whole of Europe. The Nazis, when he went after the Russians.
Yep.
And in this instance with Charles XII, I think this really, at this he had to abandon it. And,
well, you know people ask why they should study history. And I'm thrilled if you're listening to this podcast, because Anthony and I have done now 8 seasons of this. But this is precisely why history is useful to you. And it's a master class of human error. And if you don't learn from other people's mistakes, you're going to make them yourself. The story you've just told about Charles XII is a story that Napoleon repeated and that Hitler repeated and that will continue to be repeated by people who are ignorant of history. So even a great general and even someone who is as steadfast as this guy, I mean, he just refused to retreat. His stubbornness was obviously a big part of the problem, as was his lack of strategy going into the Russian winter. And they marched on Moscow. They failed desperately. He said, God is testing us. So they kept going. But he was shot in the foot during that battle. So this is quite a revolting story. He had the wound cauterized. So that's when you take a red-hot piece of metal and you burn it closed so that the melted skin seals the wound. But he had a rotten foot for the rest of his life, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And we just have to bear in mind this is the late 1600s. This is the 1700s now.
Yeah.
There's nothing that we know of today of how to heal a wound like this. So he did effectively, and you know, I think it would have become a major problem for him, probably been amputated if he didn't die at the age of 37. So this could have been his failing later on, definitely later on in life. But he was always at the front.
Yeah, well, he was trying to, even after he'd been shot in the foot and they'd cauterized the wound, he still demanded to lead the battle on a stretcher. I mean, he couldn't stand up, but he was giving commands from the stretcher.
Yeah, so they brought his litter along and he was driving the troops. Dion, it was incredible what he did. But I think after the attack had failed, and the bulk of the Swedish army had to surrender, surrendered to the Russians. Charles saw the writing on the wall, so he fled to Turkish, like a Turkish held territory, and I think he ended up in Turkey.
Yeah, he was a guest. He was an unwanted house guest of the Ottoman Emperor. He just said, "Hey, I'm here. Give me a place to stay," and he became a royal refugee there for like, what, 5 years.
Yes, and you know, I think that the Turkish they accepted
Sultan.
Him, but the wife, Sultan, sorry, apologies, the Turkish Sultan accepted him, but his wife was enamored with Charles XII, and that gave him a little bit of room, and she convinced her husband to actually have a go at the Russians, and you know, that's why I think Charles XII, he realized when he fled from the war, he realized that he needed stronger allies because he was absolutely committed in all he wanted to do now was take out Russia. And he needed time to work out how to build allies and build up another force from Sweden. The Swedish army never came, essentially, to go back into Russia. So he settled in Turkey for what turned out to be 5 years, Gareth, which was a long time.
Well, while he was there, he cost the Ottoman Sultan an absolute fortune in his demands, the property damage. They destroyed, they had parties, they tore the place to pieces. It would be like having the worst possible house guest you could imagine. And at one point, the Sultan actually sent Janissaries, which are their riflemen, to politically and politely eject him. But he responded by barricading himself in the house and starting a gunfight. So eventually the Ottomans just said, look, how much money must we give you to go away? And he took a huge paycheck from them and then hopped on a horse. This is phenomenal. He rode from Constantinople, Istanbul, to Sweden, which is a long way. He did it in 14 days. On horseback, changing his mounts constantly so that they weren't exhausted. That's 215 kilometers a day, I worked out. That's faster than most modern cars in that part of the world if you're stuck in traffic. Unbelievable haste and speed and horsemanship.
Yeah. And he, I think as well, like the Swedish council that were ruling while he was not there basically said, look, if you don't come home, we're putting your sister in charge. So he took the money that he got from the Sultan and off he went. But just prior to that, his nemesis, old Augustus, he was plotting, you know, and I think the people within the court of the Sultan, I think it was Ahmed III, were plotting to hand him over to Augustus of Saxony, who mm-hmm. was now restored in Poland. And that would have been the worst thing in the world for Charles. Yeah. So Charles, he had to leave, you know, like you said, he had to leave Turkey, and he also needed to sort things out in Sweden as well.
Well, he arrived in Sweden. He was filthy. He was starving. And he was ready to launch new wars because he was smiling from ear to ear about the opportunity of going to war again. Apparently, interestingly enough, he wore the same blue uniform for years until it fell apart. It actually became threadbare and fell off of him. So he wasn't particularly interested in any kind of finery either. He didn't dress like many of the royals of the time. And we were talking about Louis the 15th in France, who was dressed in brocade and frills and, you know, wore makeup and had his hair and wig coiffured every morning. This is not what Charles the 12th was doing. He was fighting and getting dirty, wearing the same old filthy stuff over and over again.
And you know that when going into an army or I don't know if it's true around the world, but I know it was true in it once upon a time here, is that the more worn your uniform looked, the more you've actually done what you need to do. You know, mm-hmm. you've done your task, mm-hmm. and the Afrikaans, they call it hoden. And so, in other words, your brown uniform was almost white from the sun.
Those are the men you take seriously, right?
Exactly, and I think Charles the 12th. It actually. You know, I've read, and it's a rumor that this actually emanated from him.
Wow!
If we look at many of the Nazis and nationalists used to celebrate his birthday and took up a lot of the things that he did. So there's definitely legacy, both good and bad.
So they couldn't stop him because he just wanted to keep going to war, and he. Upon arriving back in Sweden, immediately decided to take on Norway twice. He fought in trenches with the common soldiers, shouted encouragement while waving his pistols around and his sword like a mad Viking preacher, screaming Bible verses at them. I mean, if you were a man fighting alongside this guy, I think you'd feel pretty chuffed that he was your leader. But eventually, he bit off more than he could chew, because there was a siege in 1718 at the Frederiksten fortress, and he got shot in the head.
Yeah, so his strategy was never fully unfolded. You know, he had 60,000 troops that were with him, men, but the plan, nobody ever realized what the plan would do, and he was young. But what was happening, Gareth, was compared to 16 years prior, when he just started, he was starting to become much more all round as a general and as a leader. And it's always difficult to say what his legacy was going to be afterwards. But I think that he'd learned a lot, and he was becoming less stubborn. what you can see from the outside, maybe there was. You know, I think there could have been a good future as he started to figure things out, but he wanted to bring, he really wanted to bring this prestige back to the Swedish arms after those bad defeats that he'd suffered, because this is a guy that came out of the blocks and won seven in a row, mm-hmm. and then he got knocked a bit by Peter the Great. So at the time of his death, you know, I think that maybe the world was robbed in a way a little bit of yeah. what more he could have done.
Yeah.
But I think, Gareth, as well, on the other hand, there were a lot of people that were tired of stubbornness and that felt that Sweden could have been in a better position if he would have agreed to some of the peace treaties, etc. So, he was shot in the side of the head. There's a picture. You can see it straight away. The minute you type in Charles the 12th, out it pops. There's a picture of him with the wound in the side of his head, and there's been rumors around this and debates around who shot him. You know, was it friendly fire, or was it the Norwegians? And to such an extent that I think they've exhumed his body on a few occasions to try and determine what actually happened.
Wow. Well, I suppose you could say that this guy was fearless, almost to the point of derangement, but he certainly knew what he was about. And I agree with you. I think it's a very valid point you raise, that maybe we missed out on the best of Charles XII because he was taken out at that siege. And who knows that he might have led Sweden to even greater glory. Certainly after that, I don't think Sweden could be considered one of the major players in European politics. I mean, this was pretty much their apogee when he started his reign. That was about the height to which the Swedish would climb. And after that, no longer.
Yeah, and a lot of, you know, afterwards and after his death, a lot of people thought, you know, he's a simple and uneducated soldier king, but it was so far from that. And that's why I mentioned the point, you know, it's because he in his later life, he became more and more occupied with new ideas in administration. And some of them weren't put into place while he was in Turkey. He sent a whole lot of different ideas for the administration in Sweden, which they didn't put into play. And his sister actually put that into play, or, you know, post his death. So you know, not only, you know, was he a skilled tactician, and I think the big thing with a skilled tactician with personal leadership is insane. And I think that's why we're talking about him today, is that he was, you know, he knew exactly what he wanted to achieve, but he was there to make sure that they executed on. You know, often people come up with these great ideas, but they weren't there in execution. So, you know, I think that that's really what made him. But we shouldn't discount his intellectual pursuits.
No, he was very interested in mathematics and geometry, and it's worth saying as almost a postscript to this that he was very admired by Voltaire, of all people, who thought he was the perfect warrior king. He also is supposed, there's a legend of how he was in the trenches fighting in one of these battles, and a grenade was thrown into the trench, and he picked it up and threw it back. That's how brave this guy was. So I think for all of his enemies, it was probably a great relief that he was no longer there.
Yeah, that's in a very, very interesting time in history. And I think a very interesting, obviously he's one of the most written about figures in Swedish history, you know, and as I mentioned, a lot of nationalists have still today are celebrating his birthday or his day of death.
I think he's worth spending a bit of time thinking about. And if you want to read more about him, there's plenty, especially if you can read a bit of Swedish. But thanks, Ant. That's a wrap on King Charles XII of Sweden, someone I didn't know a whole lot about before this episode, and now I'm looking for more. Blind History is brought to you by Vitruvius Design. Visit them at vitruviusdesign.co.za.